Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for tuning in to the Vigilance Press podcast. My name is James Dossey. I'll be your solo host today. I have a very, very special guest with me. I am so excited to have on board Jeff D. Jeff, how is the weather up there?
Hi, James. Hi, everybody. cold down here.
Is it?
Texas, yeah.
Oh, you're in Texas. Well, For some reason, I thought you were up in Ohio.
No.
I don't know
Austin,
why.
Texas area. Though, you know, what counts as cold for us is probably not that impressive to folks in the north.
Yeah, my friends in Canada are always making fun of me when I throw my jacket on and they're still in t-shirts and shorts.
Yeah.
But no, it is fantastic to have you on board. For anyone who doesn't know Jeff D's name by heart, James, your host, is actually one of these guys who used to sit there and trace his artwork out of the Deities and Demigods book, which you've just done a great Kickstarter on actually recreating all the artwork from that had been lost by TSR. And that was really exciting to be part of, and you're doing a couple of other similar projects that we can talk about in a little bit.
Yeah.
But, you know, how long have you been doing professional role-playing game and other illustrations?
Well, I grew up in a little town just south of Lake Geneva across the border in Illinois.
Mm-hmm.
So I was showing up when I was in junior high. I was showing up at the Dungeon Hobby Shop in Lake Geneva when all of TSR was, you know, this converted house where the ground floor was the hobby shop and upstairs was the company.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I got out of high school and I went to art school and started bringing art in to show them at that building, and they said, hey, would you like to do some stuff in Dragon magazine? So around about 1976,
mm-hmm.
I did my first few illustrations in Dragon. There was a page of Snitz, if you remember Tom Wham's Snitz Smashing game.
Trying to remember.
One of those little board games they published in Dragon magazine. And he had these little creatures a big nose with some legs.
Right, right, right.
And
I remember
they
those.
Ran around. I got inspired, so I did a page of Snitz, like one from Star Wars and superhero Snitz, and, you know, Tecumel Snitz because I was big into the Tecumel game. And that's the other thing that I did early in Dragon magazine were some drawings for the Legions of the Petal Throne miniatures painting guide. That was also about 1976. So that was kind of while I was in art school, and I quit the art school early because I got hired on full time in TSR's art department, and I was 18.
Wow, that's a good start for you. Now, how many years did you spend as a full time TSR artist?
I'm gonna guess off the top of my head, it was about three.
3 years? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that was really that was the late 70s. That was when a lot of the traditional role playing games really started getting a real foothold and a lot of popularity. I mean, Dungeons & Dragons obviously kind of started everything, but
the big breakthrough for D&D was the James Dallas Egbert thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that happened just before I went into art school.
Okay. Okay.
So, but by the time I got back and got the job, they weren't in the one building anymore. I mean, they had the Dungeon Hobby Shop was a corner store, and they had two floors above that, so it was like a real company.
Mm-hmm. Like a real company. Yeah, it's kind of funny. Our ideas of a real company these days are so different from back then. You know, back then you had like bullpens and, you know, everybody sitting around typewriters and whatnot. Nowadays, it's, you know, some guy behind a keyboard. That's a company.
Right. Well, you know what? They had really made a serious business out of it.
Yeah, yeah. No, they pulled together some incredible talent, too. Not just you. We were also chatting about some of the other names that I remember from that time period. There was Dennis Lube, who's a gaming buddy of yours, right?
Yeah, Dennis lives in the Austin area also, and we game together mm-hmm. every week.
Yep, and Errol,
he wasn't at TSR though.
He wasn't a TSR? Okay.
No.
Okay.
However,
no, I'm trying to remember where I did.
Another guy who was a TSR, yes, which is Dave LaForce, also known as Diesel, always signed his stuff DSL. Mm-hmm. He lives in the Austin area and games with us also.
I remember him. I remember, you know what, I was actually just flipping through my copy of Deities and Demigods to try and remember things to talk to you about, and
yeah,
I actually saw the Lizard Man deity picture that he'd drawn. I remember how cool I always thought that design was, but yeah, he was one of those artists that I used to pick out too and go, oh, hey, there's one of his. But he didn't seem as prolific as you guys, or at least not from the products that I
usually saw. Did a lot of maps.
Mm.
And not
okay,
quite as much illustration. But though he did a lot. And you mentioned my project to recreate this lost TSR art, which we can get
Go ahead
later.
We can talk a little bit about that now, actually.
The link from our previous topic is that Diesel and I are going to be coordinating and recreating both of our artwork on the next phase.
Okay, is that going to be for another chapter of the Deities and Demigods?
Yeah, he was supposed to be doing a parallel Kickstarter on the Q1 Queen of the Demon Web Pits.
Mm-hmm.
Project, which is just it's got 1 week left on it now for those of you that want to go throw money at it, but I guess with the holiday season things were slow at Wizards of the Coast because we have to get their permission to reproduce this copyrighted work to which they own the rights, so and they've been extremely nice about it, but they were just not quite fast enough in getting him his letter of permission. So the day came when I had to launch my Kickstarter, and I did, and we decided we'll just wait for the next one, which is coming up real soon.
All right. So just to give everybody a little background information on that, the story, as I understand it, was that TSR used to focus, used to be more of like a work-for-hire type arrangement. And Wizards of the Coast, the new owners, are a lot more modern, it seems like. They allow the artists to receive recover their original artwork and maintain ownership of the original piece. Is that right?
I don't know. Not having worked for them directly,
I think
I have heard things to that effect, but don't quote me.
Okay.
But it is absolutely true that TSR was work for hire, and so when I left there, all of the artwork that I had done, except for just a couple of pieces that I snuck away, stayed in their files for a while. And, you know, I thought it was still there when Wizards took over. And shortly after that, Wizards announced that since they did have a policy of returning original art to the artists, that they were going to open up those TSR files and return that art. And I said, great. I got in touch and sent them my contact information, and I waited and I waited and I waited and nothing. So I got back to them and they said, we're sorry, but apparently your art was destroyed before we ever got it. And the word that I hear is that some clueless functionary who was just trying to make space in their files one day, though possibly under orders from some higher level clueless person, I don't know, took handfuls of art out to the dumpster and just tossed it.
Oh, heartbreaking.
And there is a rumor that a certain amount of dumpster diving took place on that day. I know that some things that I've done still exist. Like a great example is the painting I did on the back cover of Q1, which is a warrior in like a yellow tunic, and he's lying on his back in a spider web, and there's all these little yellow spiders crawling over him. Mm-hmm. That original still exists. I've seen a photo of it on the internet hanging on somebody's wall. So that, you know, that exists. But it's scattered pieces here and there, as far as I can tell.
So your goal with this, you know, when did you get the idea to try and recreate this artwork?
Just earlier this year, it just seemed like a thing to do that people be interested in. I'm always being asked, you know, oh, do you still have this one? Oh, do you still have that one? Could you draw me a picture in the style of this or that? And in fact, one guy who's now I'm going to be embarrassed because I don't remember his name, hired me to recreate the cover art from Village of Hamlet,
which I
did for him. And I thought, you know, I don't want to do this piecemeal. If people are really interested, why not just you know, bite the bullet and do it? So I asked around on Facebook, and people seemed interested. So I launched the Egyptian one, and it went really, really well.
Yeah, I think it was less than a week for that one to be fully funded.
4 days.
4 days, yeah.
4 days.
That was pretty amazing.
Now, Q1 is not doing quite so well, and it's because of the nature of the pictures in it, I think. You know, everybody remembers characters better than they remember scenes, and I did a lot of scenery in that. But, you know, it's still cool stuff, and I think it's like $120 shy of its goal right now.
Yeah.
And a week to go as of this recording, so it's going to come through.
Yeah, I think considering that I just got some cash from Santa, I think I can help nudge that one closer to completion there. But no, that one is another project that's coming up. And then you're recreating more art from. Let's see, what was the next one?
The next one, I haven't really made a big major announcement, but it's just a week away, so I can tell people. It's going to be the Norse chapter of Deities and Demigods, which Diesel and I picked because it's almost evenly split between him and I, who did the art on that.
Very cool. Right.
So we'll be doing that in parallel, and we don't know really what to expect. I mean, it may be that there is a finite number of dollars out there to support that work, and we both of our projects will fail because, you know, people will choose one or the other, and then there won't be enough money there. But we don't know. We're going to try it.
Okay.
It seems like it's. I mean,
so you're actually going to do it as two separate projects as opposed to one combined project.
Seemed easier to clearer that way.
Okay.
We contacted Errol Otis to see if he wanted to jump on, but he's apparently already got paying work, so. So not today.
But, yeah, he was one of the names that I remembered. He did the cover to Deities and Demigods, didn't he?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, Errol was awesome, you know. Yeah. I ran into him at North Texas RPG Con.
When is that?
Earlier this year. Okay. I think it's spring or summer.
Okay.
I'm going to be there again this year, and I don't know if he's coming back. But it was cool. We did a panel, me, him, and Paul Jacquez.
Ah, yes, another luminary.
Yes.
So I'm going to see if I can't get out there to Texas this year myself. I've been switching over from I was you know, involved in a different con circle for years and years, you know, going to the animation conventions and such, but you know, segueing over into the D&D stuff. I mean, I started going to Gen Con about 2 years ago now, and discovered again everything that I missed, you know, about role playing games and how it's still alive. And I'm just so happy to have met such wonderful people just in the few short years that I've done this. But one of the things that I was looking at, and you were actually showing me, but you're not just doing your artwork on these Kickstarters. We're actually you're trying to jumpstart a role playing game or two here.
Correct.
One of them that really looks interesting to me is Cave Master. What's going on with that? At this point in the recording, we had a small glitch, and Jeff D's voice was not recorded. So I'm going to introduce the idea of Cave Master myself. Cave Master is a role playing game that was conceived as a role-playing game that cavemen could actually have played. So your character sheets, or your character skins in this case, don't actually have any numbers or letters or words on them. Everything can be done in symbols and with stones. And stones are left on the character sheet, or, you know, picked up in your hands and used depending on which circle they'd be placed on. On the character skin. So I'm going to segue now into the actual demonstration of how gameplay works from Jeff D. But for more information, please check out the Cave Master Kickstarter. Just look for Cavemaster RPG at Kickstarter.com. Okay, cool, cool. So tell us a little bit. Now, the resolution system, is that what you call Habilis?
Habilis, yeah. After Hobo Habilis, Handyman.
Gotcha.
Our ancient ancestor believed, there's a little bit of controversy, as there is in a lot of areas of paleontology, but widely believed to be the first hominid ancestor to make and use tools.
Okay.
So it seemed like a natural thing. Plus, the mechanic involves handfuls of rocks, so it's a perfect fit. We can pretend to play it here on the podcast. Pretend you've got on your character skin on the dirt floor of the cave in front of you, right? Mm-hmm. You've got your stick that has been charred in the fire, so you can scrawl little markings on your character skin. There's a big circle in the middle that has some stones sitting in it. Those are your core stones. Those stones represent your caveman's general ability to do stuff that pretty much any caveman ought to be able to do, right? Mm-hmm. Running and hiding and jumping and climbing and stuff like that, right? Then, next to that, there may be another circle with a little picture drawn in it representing your caveman's line of work, right? What is the main thing that he does? Maybe you've drawn a little shaman doing magic. Maybe you've drawn a little warrior holding up a spear, right? And there could be some stones in there. Those are bonuses that you get when your caveman tries to do things that fall within their area of expertise, right?
Okay.
And then there could be other circles drawn on your character skin with other simple cave drawing indications in them for things like, oh, maybe you've got keen eyesight, maybe you're really strong, maybe you're very handsome. Stuff like that. It's got general ability, it's got professional expertise, and then it's got personal advantages. So let's say you're not a warrior caveman. We'll make it really, really simple. You're just some dude. Maybe you make things out of animal skins. So you've got your leather crafting profession and so on. And you've got five stones in your core stone circle, okay? And you're out picking berries one day, and you get jumped by a jackal, okay? The jackal has four stones. This is really, really simple. We're ignoring all the special ability stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you pick up your five core stones. That's the only ones you ever pick up off your character skin. Okay?
Okay.
The other ones stay there to indicate what kind of bonuses they give you. You take your five stones and you split them secretly between your two hands. Okay?
Ah.
And
okay.
The more evenly you split them, the more you're playing it safe. And the more you risk putting them all in one hand or more of them in one hand than the other, right? Then the more you're overexerting yourself or being risky, okay?
Gotcha.
So you do that. Just do it in your head. Decide how many are in your left and how many are in your right. Okay. And I'm going to do that as the cave master, right? I'm doing the same thing with the four stones that represent the jackal.
Okay.
Okay. Got your stones?
I got my stones.
Pick my left hand or my right hand.
Okay. I am going to pick your right hand.
Okay, in my right hand, I got two stones. And okay. I want your left hand.
In my left hand, I have four.
So you got four to my two. You okay. did two damage to the jackal.
Okay.
Now, normal equipment, everyday equipment is assumed. So you hit it with a stick or bashed its head in with a rock or whatever, right? Something okay. you just have on you. What happens is, of the four stones the jackal has, put two of them aside. Those are injury. And okay. And now we go to round two, and the jackal's only got two stones, tier five.
Gotcha. So, in this case, alright, so we split our stones again.
To round two? This jackal desperately wants to get away, okay? And this okay. requires another one of these tests to see if he can get loose.
Okay.
I know where my stones are, because that's what he's trying to do. He's not trying to attack you, he's trying to run away. And okay. you're trying to stop him. So I want
I'm a vengeful caveman.
Okay, I want your left
hand. You want my left hand? That's two stones.
How many? Two stones? Two.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and pick one of mine?
I'm going to take your right.
My right again? Zero stones.
Okay.
So I don't get away.
Okay.
And actually, when I say rounds, every exchange in combat is, like, first it was your turn to attack the jackal, then it was its turn to get away, and now it's your turn again, so you can initiate an attack if you want.
Oh, okay, so that was...
Its action was to try to get away. Now your action can be to, you know, bash its head in, if you will.
Okay, so it doesn't... So they're not simultaneous events. Like, it wouldn't take damage in resolving its action.
It does. Normally, it does. There's complexity to the combat system. Like, if you declare that you're just defending, you get a plus one to the number of stones that you reveal. Right, no matter which hand.
Okay.
But in that case, you don't do damage back to the other guy. There's also rules for engagement, because one of the things we wanted to model very carefully was like a mammoth hunt.
Mm-hmm.
So in a mammoth hunt, one of the members of your tribe is going to basically go up and get the thing's attention and stand there and suffer its attacks while everybody else comes in from the side and behind. And in that case, it is engaged with that one guy that's holding its attention. So it will do damage in combat exchanges with that guy. But the people attacking from the side are safe.
Okay. That sounds like a really interesting and a very simple system.
The fun comes in, of course, when it tramples that guy holding its attention and, you know, and then turns its attention to someone else, or somebody else sees that their friend is in trouble and they take his place. There's rules for all that. Simple little rules.
It sounds like a really cool system for trying to introduce new people to gaming, too. It sounds like a very straightforward, simple kind of contest that most people can relate to from street games and... You know, they're very simple.
I hope so. I mean, one of the things that I'd like to see more in the gaming hobby is, you know, more accessibility. It's a difficult hobby because tabletop role playing gaming is so much about making your own entertainment. Excuse me. And, I think that makes it difficult for publishers because they're always trying to find ways to make themselves indispensable.
Right.
And so the big trend lately has been, you know, you pay $100 and you get this giant brick of hardbound books, and there's all the special components you have to have if you're gonna play this game. Right.
So, some of the books even brag about how bulletproof they are, but go ahead.
And you know, I sympathize with the publishers, but I think it's a vicious cycle where the games get less and less accessible as publishers have to crank the price to get more money from the dwindling number of players and make the components more unique and special, so you have to get them from the publishers so that they remain relevant. That makes the games less and less accessible. It's going to reduce the number of people playing, and it's just bad. And I don't know what the correct answer is. I've jumped to Kickstarter to try to, you know, as a game maker, to go straight to the audience. Maybe that will help.
But with Cave Master, anybody
can go out, pick up some rocks, and play the game.
So it's very simple to remember. If you just go to Kickstarter and look for Cave Master RPG, you will definitely see the little video they put together. I love the music on that video, by the way.
Thank you. That that was actually a piece of music written by Jason Rosenblum, who's another guy that games with me. He wrote that several years ago in my first failed attempt to make a mini MMO.
Oh, okay.
It was a science fiction game called Fringeway, kind of a alien planet exploration game. And then the music that is with the video for the Q1 Queen of the Demon Pits art Kickstarter is another piece he did for my second failed attempt to make a mini MMO, and that was that was for Gargantua, which was a giant monster MMO.
Oh, very cool.
I'm devastated. The Fringeway thing was, I didn't really know what I was doing, and I didn't really have an expectation of finishing, but Gargantua got really far and was looking really good, and then we had problems and it fell apart. I'd like to maybe launch that again through Kickstarter if I can find me a programmer.
Well, I think if anybody's listening, if they want to contact Jeff D, they can probably find you on Facebook and offer your services if you're a mercenary programmer. We actually had a gentleman on a couple of months ago now. Let's see. Let me make sure I get the company name right. Twisted Kitty, I think it was. But they were going from a tabletop game to a video game, and I'll post the
interesting.
I'll get that in just a minute, but I'll look that up. But the interesting thing about that for me was the idea that somebody could take, you know, the writing and the flexibility of a role playing game and try to apply it to video games. Video games have been doing it, you know, since their inception, and you know, they've been aping tabletop gaming for so long. But
now with D&D 4, tabletop gaming is aping them. So.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, you know, for better or worse. That's one of those things that it seemed to me like a symptom of that earlier problem you mentioned about companies looking for new ways to access a new market. And I think that's what D&D was doing. I think they'd basically run out of things to sell their current people, and they wanted they needed to open up a new market there. So, but let me really quick jump on my computer here. I know I have that company name, and I'm going to get it wrong if I don't look it up. So, aside from Cave Master, do you and of course you have the Eternal. One of the very first, if not the very first, was where does Villains and Vigilantes stand as far as superhero role playing games?
If you think that it depends on your perspective. Some people say Villains and Vigilantes was the second superhero role playing game because Game Science published Superhero 2044 first. Other people will say Villains and Vigilantes was the first complete superhero role-playing game because Superhero 2044 actually lacked any detailed rules for building you're giving your characters any superpowers. It was kind of a setting without a superpower system.
Ah, okay.
So, you know, we'll take the kudos as, you know, first complete.
First complete, yeah.
That's fine. That's honorable enough.
Cool. Now, the game that I was mentioning before, now that I've looked it up, it is Miffed, M-I-F-F-E-D, as in annoyed. Oh, but okay. It's Miffed Kitty Press. And the role-playing game that they publish is called Status Quo, and it's a sci-fi role-playing game that's actually freely available from their website. You know, so you can download the PDF of the role-playing game and contact them if you're interested in supporting their efforts to turn it into a video game. But, maybe they're a group you could contact and, you know, share some programming resources. But, that was a really interesting interview. But when I was looking at... It was kind of fun when I saw the posts on Facebook for the recreation of the artwork. It kind of made me stop and wonder, and I actually cracked open a bunch of my really old art boxes of stuff that I've drawn and made me start thinking about doing something similar.
Yeah.
But
where are your originals?
Just basically in storage. Here's the thing. I've never really published outside of small fan base stuff, but I've been incredibly productive as far as my little role-playing groups and things like that. And I looked back on some of my older artwork and realized how different my style has become. And that kind of dovetails into the question of when you look at your older stuff and when you're trying to recreate these old pieces, how much are you trying to stay to your old style and how much are you trying to maybe improve on the original artwork?
The question of tracing came up during our pre-show discussion. I don't trace the originals, but I do lay a grid down on them and use that grid to make sure that everything is in the same place as it was in the original.
Yeah.
And there are things that I did back then that I won't do now. Like some of the pictures do have a lot of cross-hatching on them, which I think is just ugly. And in the remakes, I have mostly gone with a gray wash to achieve the same effect. There are little things with anatomy that I'll change, but I mean, nobody would care if I was doing this if I wasn't trying to make them look like the originals. So it's really just minor touches, you know, minor course corrections to try to make the final thing look a little nicer. That's, you know, I'm not reinventing the images.
Yeah, that was something that I noticed when I was looking at as you were posting them. I was like, these are very close, but I can definitely see a more, I guess, mature line quality is what I was looking for is the word. But it just seemed like some of the smaller ones especially, I noticed because you're blowing them up to a larger format, I'm guessing. But
yeah, that's an interesting question, too. I mean, I have no way of knowing precisely what size the originals were for these pieces I'm recreating. So, you know, since the Kickstarter project is about, you know, the backers getting prints, I said, screw it. I'll just blow them all up to, you know, whatever will fit best on an 8.5x11, and that'll be the print.
Okay.
So, you know, some little tiny pictures are going to get a lot of extra special attention. And when I go to the back cover painting, that's going to be a different issue. I think I'm just going to make that big.
That's the one with the spiders.
Yes, which I'm going ahead and recreating anyway, even though I know for a fact that one does still exist. Because, you know, the people backing me are going to want prints of it anyway. I don't have the original to scan and get that from. So it's clearer and cleaner and simpler for everyone if I just bite the bullet and say, what the hell, I'll redo everything.
So getting back to the art geek questions, because I am an art geek at heart, who were your influences when, you know, you were a young man? Because you got into this business very early, right out of college there, it sounds like, or while you were in college.
Right out of art school, which I left early. So literally, I was 18 when I started working professionally at TSR. I have a lot of different images, different influences, mostly from comics, because I was a huge comic book reader, thus Villains and Vigilantes.
That's no big surprise, I'm sorry to say.
specific influences, I mean, the first really strong one was actually John Byrne and Terry Austin on X-Men.
Okay.
When you look at the... particularly the deities and demigods stuff that I did. I'm not claiming that my stuff looks like Byrne and Austin, but the tech pen work that I was doing was trying to get the kind of precision and line control that I saw that Terry Austin had in his inks.
Very cool.
And things about the anatomy are, you know, kind of cribbed from John Byrne. But after that, I went through a Frank Miller phase, you know, back in when he was doing Daredevil. I think there's some anime influences crept into my work over the years. And Mike Mignola, if there was a guy who's like the guy I wish I could really draw like now, it would be him.
Yeah, I can totally sympathize. One of the things I always liked about Mignola is he does this magic thing with just black and white, just this...
Yeah.
Where he chooses to do solid colors, where he describes a very intricate scene with very simple shapes, and I wish I could eat that part of his brain and steal that skill, because he does some amazing things. If you're not familiar with his name, check out Hellboy comics, because they are definitely worth the price of admission. The artwork is just fantastic, and he's got such a unique way of doing things. It's incredible. It's great to hear you say that, because I had a lot of the same influences just by happenstance. But of course, you were one of my main influences early on, and it was kind of funny because when I was buying role playing game books as a kid, and Dragon magazine and things like that, the late 70s, early 80s, you were one of the first names where I started associating names with artwork, because until that point, I don't know if this was policy or just happened to be the way that people started signing their artwork, but illustrations frequently didn't have a name by them, but there was this letter D by all of my favorite pictures in this book, you know, and I started wondering, well, who is that? And I started associating, that's Jeff D, and I can remember that name. And I just started realizing, oh, okay, well, I recognize who did that piece, but that's not this guy. And I started realizing there are people behind those pens, and that started kind of putting me the idea that's like, hey, wait, maybe I can do this. And, you know, that goes, you know, to my earliest, inspirations. But after that, you know, a lot of my inspirations, of course, when I started getting a more historical perspective, Frazetta is a huge, I'm a huge fan of his stuff. A lot of manga artists. So you said you were influenced somewhat by anime. What any specific artists there, or
no? I couldn't name specific artists.
Okay,
it hasn't been that strong of a thing with me. But I certainly have seen a lot of anime, and appreciated it. So I just elements crept in. Now there, I did have a short stint working in comics, and one of the things I did was penciled a few issues of the, what was it, Mospida?
Ah, okay.
Comic from Robotech. Kamiko.
Yeah. Okay.
So that, but I think I got that gig because people were already saying there were little anime-like things they saw in my work. So,
okay.
It's mild, but it's there.
Yeah.
There is a story behind my signature, by the way.
Oh, please tell it.
The D with the two dots?
Uh-huh.
If you crack open your copy of The Hobbit and look at Tolkien's map of, I believe it's the map of the Lonely Mountain, that is supposed to have been made by Durin. Durin signs his work with a rectangle with the dwarvish rune D with a dot before and after it.
Nice. Very cool. I had never made that connection before.
I don't make a big deal out of it. I'm no dwarven king, but
no, that's really cool.
That's what inspired me to sign that way.
Oh, very cool. Speaking of The Hobbit, have you seen that trailer?
I have.
I love the singing. Just made the hair on my neck stick up. I was just like, that's amazing. But big fan of Tolkien, too. But one of the things I did want to ask you about, since you mentioned comics, I actually still have around here, and I should bring it to the next convention I know you're going to be at. But I actually have the Villains of Vigilantes comic book that you published, I think it was early 80s. It was
84 or so.
Yeah. So... That was just a short limited series, as I recall. Now, did you have any other forays into taking, you know, that particular game into, or how did that come about? And did you ever follow up on that with any other projects of a similar nature?
I think it came about because Eclipse had just done the Champions comic book.
Ah, okay.
And I think they felt that was an up-and-coming thing that people were going to get excited about. And luckily, we got signed before the Champions comic book tanked. But that's why they didn't continue our series after the four issues. At least that's my excuse.
So I asked some of my friends out there on different sites, you know, and Facebook, and if they had any questions for you to let me know. And the one that I've come back with was have him talk about his remake Deities and Demigods Art project. I'm like, yeah, uh-huh. I think we got that covered. But so yeah, that was a.
You know, it wasn't just remakes either. In that that chapter of Deities and Demigods,
right? You got some original.
Many chapters have, yeah. Yeah, of Deities and Demigods have blanks because that was a buttload of gods that we had to draw, and only so many hours in a day. So you know, we had to make a call: which of these guys are we actually going to draw? Well, I don't have that time constraint now, so. I said, well, if you guys throw enough money at me in Kickstarter, I will create new drawings for the blanks that were left in the original book.
Mm-hmm.
And that turned out to be 8 characters, which all got done.
Yep, yep.
Thanks to the support of my backers on that project. That was a lot of fun.
Now, this is some for the more obscure, or actually not obscure, this is more obscure information, but... for the people who go all the way back to the first edition of the Deities and Demigods book, like myself, any chance of seeing... I mean, I'm trying to remember if you had specific... I think you did one or two... Or you did a couple of the Melnibonian, right?
Yeah, I did a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, you did one or two.
And in fact, the I think the straw that finally... okay, I'm going to mix my metaphors here. The thing that finally convinced me that that I should go ahead and try this Kickstarter, the first one, was a guy hired me to do a recreation of the Elric drawing of Deities and Demigods. And I did that and was like, well, you know, this is a great opportunity and people seem to be interested, so let's make a real thing out of it. The problem with me redoing the Elric art that I did is it's not just a question of Wizards of the Coast. I'm sure they'd give me permission. The problem is that stuff got taken out of the book in later printings because they didn't, in fact, actually have the rights to do it.
Right.
So this would, to be upfront and honest about it, I would have to approach Moorcock and say, do you mind if I recreate these images that nobody had any right to create and publish in the first place? I haven't attempted that yet.
Yeah, it does take a special kind of guts to do that, even though it's been, what, 30 years? So
I know, but... You know, I feel bad about the way that went down.
Yeah, yeah. But let's see, what other chapters do we have in that? So there was a Cthulhu chapter, I think, that I can't remember if that made it all the way through.
That was Errol Otis. That was taken out also. These were both things that Chaosium had licensed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And the inside story was they were putting together Deities and Demigods. They wanted to put in the Cthulhu and Melibone and stuff. So they went to Chaosium and they said, do you mind if we do this? And Chaosium said, well, that's fine as long as you credit us in the book, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they said, no problem. They being, you know, management at TSR. And so, great, we sat down, we drew the pictures, the book got put together and published, and wouldn't you know, there's no mention of Chaosium anywhere in that original first printing.
Oops.
And Chaosium got angry, and they came out with a second printing that put the thank you notice in, but that was too little too late, and Chaosium said, nuh-uh, you guys didn't live up to your end of the deal, and they had to take it out.
Which was a shame, but anyway.
For want of a simple thank you, which you know should have been in the first place.
Yeah, for one of a nail, the shoe was lost, and so on and so on. So, what other upcoming projects do you have that you're excited about? That you've got a lot of artwork coming, and the Cavemaster game. What have I forgotten to bring up here?
Villains and Vigilantes.
Villains and Vigilantes. Who's heard of that? that has got to be one of the biggest. Turning points, I think, in gaming for me, because I don't know whose game was first, but I know that was the first superhero game I ever found. And I remember eagerly ripping it off the shelf at the gaming store that at the time I think I had to drive 45 minutes to get to the nearest store that carried role-playing games. But I remember flipping through it and seeing characters, and I still, you know, some of my favorite characters still pop to mind, like I think her name was Laserfire, was one, but just some really cool artwork, and it felt really different from everything else I'd seen in role-playing games, and it covered my favorite topic of superheroes, which is, that was a first. So it was really exciting to see that. Where are you guys going? What have you guys got coming up with? Let's see, you've got the Monkey House Games. It's called Villains of Vigilantes 2, is that right?
2.1. There was an original Villains of Vigilantes, wasn't very good, and then there was a second edition where, you know, it's amazing what the difference between being 17 and writing a role playing game and being 21. we really turned it into something you could actually play and enjoy long term, and so that was the revised edition. 2.1 is basically the revised edition with some typos cleaned up, and a little bit of new material put in, and all new artwork.
Ah, okay.
So, like, Jack, who is a huge fan of Mexican wrestling movies, had this article he had written that had never been published with Mexican wrestling moves for Villains of Vigilantes. That went in. Nice. We expanded and updated the information on the government organization Chess. The back cover of V&V 2.1 is, in fact, the origin story of Shatterman and Condor from the comic book that never got told.
Cool.
That came out last July.
Okay.
But we have announced that we're working on V&V 3. We're going to bring it up to date.
Now, what changes do you guys have planned for it?
Well, here's the main thing. You know, there has been a rift in superhero gaming since Champions, where, and I guess technically since Superhero 2044, because supposedly points were going to be used to make your powers. They just didn't really tell you how. Between random generation, like in V&V, and point construction, like in Champions. And all games since then have had some variation of one of those two approaches, right?
Right.
Because really that's all there is. But what bothered me, I mean, I have great respect for Champions. I'll tell you. I mean, I'm not surprised that it did as well as it did. But on the other hand, I love random generation because I don't like to toot my own horn that much, but I think we had the more interesting characters because random generation takes you places you wouldn't have normally thought of. And I think there's a big danger with construction systems that all you're ever going to see are thinly disguised remakes of popular superheroes and villains. But what bothers me about V&V is, you know, I've been there. I played in the campaign where my character, randomly generated, had his only superpower was water breathing. No, excuse me, he had two. He had water breathing and life support. So it was kind of cool that I could take the version of water breathing that was like the Submariner, where... Mm-hmm. He's, like, empowered when he's in the water, which in V&V terms means he doesn't have to spend any power for anything that normally costs power when he's in water. And then I filled his life support suit full of water so he could be this guy. And then the Game Master was nice enough to let him carry a trident around so he had a little weapon. He could be this normal guy who never gets tired and stabs people with a trident. It was kind of cool, but compared to everybody else in the group, he sucked. A lot of V&V fans will tell you that that's one of the great things about V&V, that that it is more like comic books in that you get teams of characters that that are of different power levels. I mean, Batman is in the Justice League, right?
Right.
And I kind of get that, but I kind of don't. We kind of never meant for anybody to be stuck because of random die rolls with something that just wasn't workable. So that's the primary driving concern behind V&V3. What we're doing is we are taking the powers and making them constructible so that if you wanted to, you could build the characters from scratch. But the way you're normally going to make characters in V&V3 is you randomly construct them. You randomly choose which powers you're going to get, and you go through the step of throwing out the things that don't fit, like in V&V 2. But then, when you write them down in your sheet, each one is worth a certain number of points. And then if you want, you can customize from there. So that's our goal, is to have random generation on top of a backbone of a more balanced construction system.
Mm-hmm.
So people who want to go there can, and it doesn't have to be purely a negotiation and browbeating with your game master to try to get him to let you get away with stuff.
Very cool. Okay.
Right. That's the goal. And we've got, you know, an early version of the document we're playtesting right now, and it seems to be going extremely well.
If you need any playtesters, just let me know.
anybody who wants to playtest the game, I encourage you to sign up for our forums at monkeyhousegames.com, because that is where we will make the big announcements when we start looking for people.
Awesome, awesome. I will make sure to do that as soon as I'm done mixing the podcast. But yeah, I've actually been fortunate enough to be playtesting several superhero games this year, and I've had a lot of fun doing it, including the upcoming Marvel licensed one from Margaret Weiss Productions, and then the DC Adventures game from Green Ronin. So it's interesting how everybody is taking a very different tack. It's always nice when you have like three or four different role playing games that play in the same genre but have completely different approaches. I that to me is a very positive thing. And one of the things about Villains of Vigilantes 1 that I remember that was kind of both amusing and I think, as you mentioned, it was kind of a stumbling point, was that you started off trying to simulate yourself and then gave yourself superpowers. And
yeah, which is incredibly appealing when you are, you know, just out of high school. Mm-hmm. Or original V&V, we were still in high school, right? And big deal, right? Your starting attributes didn't make that much difference, so
right.
Really it was no big deal. And then you'd get random superpowers, and you had got to bring to the game the actual dynamics of your group of friends from real life, and the adventures would take place in your hometown where there were places you already knew.
Mm-hmm.
Made a certain amount of sense, but I think the problem with that isn't that it's necessarily a bad idea. It's just that after gaming for, you know, 40 years, how many different versions of me with different sets of superpowers do I need to play?
Yeah. Exactly. That's true. That's very true. One of the things that I do remember, you know, having the most fun with V&V was just sitting down and rolling up characters. I mean, it was very much like, in a way, if I'm sure you remember Gamma World and the original, just it was one of those systems where you pulled it off the table or pulled it off the shelf and rolled up characters and just came up with the most bizarre groups of characters, and then you had to find a good story that connected them all together. And that was the fun challenge. I think, you know, for you, you were talking about the individual challenge of having to play an individual character that was rolled up. But I think also as a GM, you know, because I was always the GM for my group, it was always, okay, how do I get this guy whose, you know, powers are, you know, came from a lightning bolt, this person who was bitten by a radioactive tarantula, and this person who's a magic user, and, you know, put them all on the same team. You know, they don't necessarily have a theme coming out of the gate. You know, we had to come up with one. So that was kind of a fun storytelling challenge. But that definitely, it's when you go with a point-based system, you do kind of lose that spontaneity. And I think the random character generation definitely, it has a place in my heart that I'd forgotten about for a while, but I've gotten back into the I've embraced it again recently. So
yeah, the random generation is great. We just don't we think it's our responsibility as game designers to do everything we can to guarantee that everybody has a good time.
Yes.
So we just don't. We want to preserve random generation, but just not run the risk of screwing anyone.
Right. That's got to be a really challenging thing. I can't wait to see where you guys go with that. So, do you have a date you're shooting for, or are you basically when it's done?
We have not announced a release date. I will just mention that 2012 is the 30th anniversary of revised V&V.
Gotcha. Okay.
That doesn't necessarily mean anything because we haven't announced a release date.
It doesn't necessarily mean anything official. We're just saying. It's just a remark. All right. Well, I've had you on the show for about an hour here, and I could easily keep talking to you about random stuff that's really cool to me, but I want to let you go so you can get some more work done. But is there anything else you wanted to chat or shout out about before I let you go?
Oh, just let me repeat the places people should go.
Yes, please.
Sequel stuff. There's my DeviantArt page. It's jeffd.deviantart.com is where I post a bunch of pictures. All the stuff I've done on these Kickstarter projects from Deities and Demigods and Q1 are all up there. Also, feel free to come friend me on Facebook. And you go to those two places, you'll find out all about my various projects that I'm doing. And monkeyhousegames.com for V&V.
Right. And again, Monkey House Games. Okay.
And unigames.prismnet.com is my other little game company, which is doing Cave Master.
Oh, quick question for you, and this may be something that this is something I meant to ask, but I kept getting sidetracked. What do you guys think of the whole open gaming license movement? And do you guys have any plans to do something like that with V&V?
I think I agree with your earlier statement about how great it is that there's all these different superhero games with different approaches.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think there ever needed to be a Windows of gaming, like a system that everything is using. I think that was bad, and I hope that that's over, and I don't think we plan on going there.
Okay. Very cool. All right.
Now, on the other hand, we do offer a compatibility license if anybody wants to do Villains and Vigilantes Adventures.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay.
So, but we're not in favor of the idea of trying to make any one system take over the world.
All right. Very cool. No, that's very interesting. No, that does. That does. That's one of the things that I noticed that a lot of different people have strong opinions about, and I was just curious where you were on it.
Yeah.
So that's very cool. All right. Well, thank you again for joining us. Just for everyone listening, Vigilance Press just released two new supplements for Mutants and Masterminds. We've got Smoke and Mirrors, and we've also got the new WatchGuard Icons book out. So one for Mutants Masterminds, one for Icons, but some new stuff coming out in the very next few days as well. So keep your eye open on the Vigilance Press Facebook group, and I will definitely be posting the link to this and all future podcasts there. And again, thank you so much, Jeff, for joining me. I'm a huge fan, always have been. And I can't wait for my Prince of the Egyptian chapter to arrive.
Coming really soon now. There's been an issue with the printer, but I'm working through it real soon now.
Oh, good.
Watch the mail.
Yes. All right.
Okay.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in. And for all our good fans out there, stay vigilant.